We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Dignity doesn't always come easy. There has been racism, sexism, discrimination over the years. We all deserve dignity, not just men, of course, as Lyndon Johnson said, but everybody. Growing up in the 1950s, history was pictured to us as a straight line of progress. Humans, at least in the Western world, steadily learned from problems and challenges, and things just got better. Through the movement of history, it was an ever-improving world. We just keep on moving forward. It's a very reassuring myth for kids to learn, but it remains just that, a myth. The truth is, though there are virtually limitless opportunities from which we can learn, we rarely do. The most obvious example is where we are in foreign policy today. I never would have imagined America could and would not learn the obvious lesson from Vietnam. Don't install a puppet government where the people don't want it, and then send in young Americans to force allegiance at the barrel of a gun. As Rocky so famously said to Bullwinkle, that trick never works. Sometimes people and movements do learn, and it is always, always for the better. And the truth is, the rights we may take for granted today did not come easily. To keep learning and growing in productive and useful ways, it's vitally important to learn how we got where we are. And as some cultural, political, and social movements have learned, it is a good idea not to try to reinvent the wheel. In fact, to try to avoid reinventing the wheel from learning from others that went before and achieved real results. Our guest today is Lisa M. Stolberg, whose new book, LGBTQ Social Movements, looks at where we are in terms of LGBTQ rights and explores how marginalized people and communities have used a wide range of political and cultural tools to demand and create change. And we all can learn from that. Gay, straight, whatever. There's a lot to learn. Lisa Stolberg, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thanks for having me, Bert. It's great to be here.
Well, Lisa Stolberg is an associate professor of sociology of education at New York University. Her research focuses on the politics of race and education, affirmative action in higher education, school choice policy and politics, and LGBTQ social change. She's the author of Race, Schools, and Hope, African Americans and School Choice After Brown, and the new book, of course, LGBTQ Social Movements. Well, again, thanks for being with us. What is your purpose in writing this book? Who is the target audience?
So I've been teaching at NYU for a little bit more than 15 years, and I've been teaching a social movements class off and on in that time. And I found that over the years that my students are really interested in social change around gender and sexuality, but that they haven't learned very much at all in school, especially in high school, about LGBTQ issues in particular. There are a lot of really great resources out there on LGBTQ social change and social change around gender and sexual diversity and inclusion, but I was looking to write something that would be short enough to teach in class and accessible to undergraduates and hopefully also high school students. And I also just thought that this was a particular moment in history when I've been having a lot of conversations with friends who are not academics about these topics, and I thought that a book for everybody who might be interested in gender and sexuality would be useful. So I wrote the book both for students and for just a general public who's interested in these issues.
There does seem to be much more interest and focus on gender equality issues now, and we have made some amazing, amazing progress, really. I mean, all of us, I mean, it was struggles for years and years and years, which you talk about, and then it seemed to happen fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, as one who was in the forefront of the reproductive rights struggle, at least in this region, since the early 1980s, I've been surprised and really concerned that in general, young women think, with regard to the reproductive issue, it's over, we won, since they personally have never experienced the time before Roe versus Wade, which, of course, in 1973, got abortions out of the dangerous back alley. They see no reason to get involved. They're not worried. They don't feel their rights could possibly be taken away. It just doesn't seem conceivable. Maybe that's a problem created by success. My daughters are 21 and 17, and equal rights for the LGBTQ community are a given. There's no controversy at all. I sense they're puzzled why there ever was discrimination. It's just so distant to them. Now, here we are. It seems fairly well established, and we've gotten beyond it. You know, gay marriage is the law of the land now. Marriage equality really is the better term. Why is it important for them who have never experienced the difficulties, the discrimination, why is it important for them to learn how we got here, since we're already here?
Well, I think that's wonderful that's the experience that your daughters have had and that young people around them have had. I think you have a question there about the importance of history, and I do want to say something about that. But I also think it's important to know that young people are still facing a lot of homophobia and transphobia in their schools and among their peers. And we know that from a lot of current research that has studied school climate. And some of that data shows that while a lot of young people are coming out, approximately 8% of high school students identify as gay, lesbian, and bisexual, and 20% of young adults identify as LGBTQ, so 18 to 34-year-olds. So that's a fairly large percent of the population. We still know that in schools there are substantial challenges, whether that has to do with heterosexism or heterocentrism, so teachers and curriculum really just kind of focusing on straight people or people who aren't transgender, so cisgender people, kind of assuming that that their students are straight or have a traditional sense of their gender identity. And we know that even in school climate, that young people who do identify as LGBTQ still experience a huge amount of homophobia and transphobia.
Really?
Over half of respondents on a nationwide recent survey said that their teachers were making homophobic and transphobic remarks in schools. So we still have work to do even among young people. But I think your question is really about why we should learn from history. And for young people who have seen a lot of success, although I'm sure we'll talk about the current administration and we are going backwards in that success. I think what we can learn from history is, one, we can learn from the mistakes and successes of activists who have come before us. You said before we shouldn't reinvent the wheel, and that's true. There's so much history that's come before, and there's so much that we can learn. We can learn about political patterns and what has worked, what hasn't worked. We can learn about how we change laws and what the limitations are, and once we change laws, whether that actually changes hearts and minds. And we can also learn about the relationship between movements, what movements like LGBTQ movements have learned from other social movements of their time, and then how those movements for social change have produced counter-reactions on the right.
Wow. Yeah, there's certainly a lot to talk about there. And I'm, I guess maybe my vantage point may not be the best, because here I am, Frank, you know, in the northeast of these currently United States, and I'm guessing in, you know, where there's like, I don't hear about any discrimination or, you know, making fun of gay people, whatever, but I suppose it does go on. I guess I'm kind of lucky, and my daughters are lucky, but it apparently still goes on. It just goes to show history doesn't change that quickly, as nearly as quickly as we would like. And yeah, we've had some great accomplishments so far. And one of the things about, I think, what I call the center, you know, the people who are not into discriminating, who are open-minded, is that we are interested in a lot of different issues, you know, justice for everybody. An example has always been guns. The NRA, the gun lobby, that's their focus entirely. And so they get all their people out like when it comes to a legislative hearing. And our side, the people on our side in the sensible center, what Arthur Schlesinger called the vital center, we got so many issues we're talking about that we don't focus on that so much. So I guess that's one of the things that these various different social movements don't always connect, shall we say. We don't always put things together, but there are things we can each learn from each other. You know, the safe energy movement, the civil rights movement, equal rights movement, all these things, you know, anti-imperialism. We rarely talk to one another. At least that's my finding. What's your sense of that?
I think that's right. There's a lot to do, and we're busy. And I think there are some activists who are single issue, but I actually think that what's great about progressives is that we do understand how complicated the world is, and that means that we have to pay attention to a lot of different identities and politics and fronts. So this movement for LGBTQ equality, just like other movements, started out a bit more as a single issue movement, particularly around gay rights and then gay and lesbian rights, and then we sort of added the focus on bisexuality and transgender identity. But I think as the movement progressed, it began to get pushed back with respect to gender and race and class, and so the movement became more intersectional and focused more on intersectional identity and multiple identities. And I think that's where we are now with this movement and with many other movements on the left, is that we're thinking about the diversity within the movement. And that just makes things complicated. It means we have a lot to do, but I think ultimately that makes the movements more successful.
Yeah, interesting point. We can, I mean, because we generally, you know, the left, whatever, we care, we have similar values, I think. And if we can, you know, share the information, I mean, what a concept, really, sharing information and learning from one another. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. Our show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and our guest today is Lisa M. Stolberg, whose new book is LGBTQ Social Movements, basically what we all can learn from one another to get to actively make real change, to win at making real change, not just to complain on the sidelines and, you know, feel woe is me, but actually achieve some results. It's a good feeling, I can tell you. And one of my proudest accomplishments of my work as a state senator in New Hampshire was banning discrimination, what had been legal discrimination on the basis of perceived sexual orientation, before my bill and other people's bills too, you know, the co-sponsors. It was legal to discriminate on the basis of perceived sexual orientation. It was actually legal. It took more than one try to get it passed. It was a heavy lift. It was surprisingly so. I remember school children who came to the legislature talking about how, and they were, their schools were opposed to equal rights, and the teachers apparently were too. They were talking about how clearly unnatural homosexuality was. And they laughed at it. You know, these were elementary school, junior high school kids. They had a misunderstanding, but that's what we had to work with. The reality is, even though, I mean, it's really only fairly recently that, you know, homosexuality became an identity. It's been around forever. It's been for eternity. You know, same-sex desire and relationships have always existed. It was only, as you point out, in the second half of the 19th century that homosexuality became an identity. What was it before then? When and why did people so identify begin to come together as a political and social entity? Big question there, but you can handle it.
So yes, I think you're right that sexual and gender diversity has existed forever.
Absolutely.
And it was really only with World War II, I would say, in the United States, that we started to see a movement around gay identity. And this is something, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, that we often identify with the late 60s and with the Stonewall Rebellion.
Yes.
But there has been some scholarship that I think is really useful that takes that timeline back a bit to World War II and really looks at the way that the military served as one of the biggest and first big communities for gay and lesbian Americans, people from all over the country who might have been the only person in their small town who had same-sex desires or who thought they had same-sex desires, found other people just like them from across the country in the military and started to create small communities, not necessarily communities that were very visible or that were out, but started to find each other and develop these communities through the war. And at the same time, we had, after World War II, the beginning of a civil rights movement for African-American civil rights. And I think that the early gay and lesbian movement learned a lot from the civil rights movement in how to identify as a distinct minority with that could fight for rights and that could have an identity that could be that could have a community built around it. So we started to see organizations that were sort of social organizations at first and just community-building organizations develop in the 50s around gay and lesbian identity, and those groups started to fight for civil rights well before Stonewall, well before the late 1960s.
And just there may be some people listening who may not be aware of Stonewall. I mean, my sense is that that's, you know, in the mythical history books, they always like to simplify things. I mean, you know, myths always rely on stories about clear, distinct turning points when everything changed. I mean, most people believe Rosa Parks was the very first black person to refuse to sit in the back of the bus. She was not. People have used the myth of protesters spitting on Vietnam veterans. It didn't happen. The point is, such myths often keep us from a more accurate awareness, which could better serve us and social, political, and cultural movements. Nowadays, most people, as we mentioned, think of Stonewall as the unique turning point of the LGBTQ movement. You point out that the movement started years before that, what was called a riot in New York City in 1969. What's the myth with regard to Stonewall, and what's the reality? And why is it important to know this stuff?
Right. So I think the myth is that the modern LGBTQ movement began with Stonewall in 1969, and the reality is that it began, I would say, after World War II, but that Stonewall was a substantial culmination
right.
of something and also a turning point. So
yeah.
Stonewall, the Stonewall Inn is a bar in the West Village in New York. I walk by it most days on the way to work. It's still there. It was
yep.
a gay bar in the 60s that, like many other gay bars at the time, faced really regular police raids and police repression. There were sort of weekly raids on this bar in the Village, and they were pretty well coordinated, actually. Usually the bar was aware when they were going to happen. And in this particular night in June of 1969, there was sort of a surprise raid on the bar late at night. And the patrons of the bar and people who were kind of out on a nice summer night around fought back and really started a multi-day uprising against the police in New York, against this police repression that they had become so just was a part of their daily lives.
Right, right.
And this really, there had been some gay rights organizations in the 60s before this, and there had been a lot of organizing around social change and the beginnings of a civil rights movement for gay and lesbian equality, but Stonewall really was a spark that started this organizational revolution. There were it came at a time, I think it's important to remember that in the late 60s, there was so much other activism going on in so many different fronts around gender equality, racial equality, the anti-war movement, and the gay liberation movement that came out of the Stonewall Rebellion or riot really drew on the tactics and the energy and even the same people that were activists in those other movements. So I think it came at a good time for activism in this country.
Yes, it certainly did. And before that, people you know, look at the 1950s as, you know, an era of great conformity, and there was a struggle back then. I mean, that whole McCarthy period was pretty ugly. And, you know, in the early 50s, going after alleged communists and taking away their rights, and a lot of people lost their jobs. At the same time, as you mentioned in the book, there was the Mattachine Society that I had heard of, not very well known. That was some real courage. And that I think it would be good for people to learn about the Mattachine Society. What can you tell us about them?
Right. So the Mattachine Society is often considered the first gay rights group in the United States or in the modern United States. It was founded in 1950, so wow, really not very many years after World War II and almost 20 years before Stonewall. It was a small group of men in L.A. who were not out of the closet and hadn't really had a gay community, an open gay community in L.A. or other places. And they came together, met in secret in building this community around their gay identity, and in really starting to develop a political agenda. There was some infighting within the group about how political to be, and just like with everything else in movements, there's always diversity of opinion.
I hate that.
That was the group that really was the first to articulate a minority rights agenda for gay men, and they didn't think of themselves as just being for gay men, but it was mostly gay men at the time. And then there was a similar lesbian organization called Daughters of Bilitis that was founded 5 years later, specifically by and for lesbians. So a similar group that sort of fought amongst itself around how political to be, but was a group that was for community building and some visibility. And those are really the two organizations that we point to as being the beginning of the modern LGBTQ movement in the U.S.
It's always difficult to be ahead of one's time. They were actually ahead of their time, but they made, you know, to me, how can we not be proud and impressed by the Daughters of Bilitis and the Mattachine Society? You know, they really, really stuck their necks out early. And this was in a very tough time, the whole McCarthyite period. And you've mentioned World War II a couple of times. I'm sure you've seen the movie The Imitation Game, which was about, I can't think of the guy's name there, that scientist who was gay, who probably saved 10, 20 million lives. He was a Brit, and he broke the code, the German code, during the Second World War. And I don't remember when he was destroyed afterwards, simply because he was homosexual. But it's important to learn that. When did he get basically destroyed? You know, he helped win the war for the good guys, but then his reputation was destroyed and his life ended early. You know, that's go ahead.
Yeah, and I think we see this with McCarthy and in the years in the late 40s and early 50s, when there was so much repression in general in this country, that there was a big move by the federal government to really purge gay people the federal government and the military. And Dwight Eisenhower in 1953 signed an executive order that basically eliminated gay government workers from the national government.
Oh, my.
So this is something that even with World War II and all of the sort of opening up that happened with that, there was definitely a repressive period after.
Wow, and interesting for the FBI. I remember now, you know, how crazed J. Edgar Hoover was against homosexuals. And there's this wonderful skit by, what's his name there? I can't even think of his name. It's a comedy skit where he's pretending to be a gay basher. And he's taking some gay man and smashing him and beating him up and saying, I hate you, because what was his name? Goldthwait. Bobcat Goldthwait did the skit. Whew, I remembered. And I hate you because you're gay and because you're queer and because I'm kind of attracted to you and I don't know what to do about it. And I think, you know, that's a big part of it, is the people repression of oneself. Because I don't, you know, it's not clear black and white. My understanding, I'm sure you know more about this than I do, but my understanding is, there's not a, you know, you're either gay or straight. There's a big spectrum of people. And, you know, to welcome that spectrum and to, you know, to, I think there's something liberating for everybody about that, and recognizing that, you know, we all have a little bit of this, a little bit of that in us. And I don't know. I just think the idea of liberation is a very nice thing. And there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. And what do leaders and participants of the early movement for equal rights for all sexual orientations. What did the leaders and participants learn from the earlier movements in the 50s, the Black Power, the Civil Rights, the New Left, and feminism, first and second waves?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things I love about studying social movements. My work also studies racial justice movements with a focus on African Americans, and that's what I knew best when I started studying LGBTQ movements. And I saw right away that there were these parallels in just the conversation around tactics and strategies. So how much is there a focus on law for social change, and how much should there be a focus on sort of turning away from the law and seeing the law as fairly useless and building alternative communities instead? And I think with this particular set of movements, there were people in the early gay rights movement who very explicitly drew on civil rights language and on Black Power language. That phrase, Black is beautiful, for instance, that came out of the Black Power movement, got turned into gay is good in the early gay rights movement, that same kind of alliterative slogan, but also this really kind of focus on taking an identity that was stigmatized and turning it into an empowering identity and an empowering slogan. And then also I just think those tactics of focusing on civil rights that were so much a part of the African-American freedom movement, particularly in the earlier phase, and focusing on laws and that conversation around, do we need to wait for public opinion to change, or can we focus on changing law first and assume that public opinion will follow? That was a conversation in the early gay and lesbian movement as well.
Wow. Yeah, that's an important conversation about, you know, and certainly during the anti-war movement, there was the question of, you know, the war keeps going on. Do we, you know, like actively participate in civil disobedience, or do we still try to change people's minds and win support for the war? My sense is both. You know, as someone said, and I wish I knew the source of this quote, politics and protest, neither sufficient, both necessary. You know, they both have to go together. And, you know, in the mid-60s, and one of the things that always happens in the safe energy movement and all these different things, there's inevitable splits within the movement. I hate when it happens, but it always happens. Just always happens. I mean, the Democratic Party, you know, a split between the centrists and the traditional Democrats. And we tend to lose that way, quite frankly. And back in the mid-60s, there was that big split between the integrationists of the Martin Luther King sector of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement of Malcolm X and the Black Panthers. And it was never really resolved, but there was a fairly serious split in those two movements, all looking at similar things. Do we integrate Black nationalists? You write of a division between assimilationists and liberationists throughout the history of the movement. I think that's fascinating. How did each view their objectives, and what's the status of all that now?
Well, I think that conversation about Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X or the Black Panthers is really important for this conversation, too, around LGBTQ social change, and that divide is complicated, too. There's a lot of scholarship that looks specifically at the way that Dr. King was radicalized in his later years, and that the two, that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, kind of came together in the last years of each of their lives. So we see even there's this complexity of both thinking about tactics for change and how we make change, and then also just thinking about the possibilities of America and American institutions to change and open up to new people. I think in LGBTQ movements, so this the framing of assimilationist or liberationist is one that a lot of people use to understand the divisions within this movement. Assimilationists tend to be those who orient themselves towards the state, towards making change through civil rights law and through other American institutions and assimilating into those institutions. They tend to see the law as a useful tool for change and as a possible tool for change, and they tend to see the mainstream norms and institutions as worth entering into. And then liberationists tend to see that those American institutions are fundamentally broken and in need of rejection and tend to favor building community-controlled alternatives and not really going through the law for social change. And they tend to think about identity as being not about sameness, but as about difference. So often in this set of movements, that gets framed as the quote-unquote normal versus the quote-unquote queer. So that are we just like you except for who we love, or are we different from you and should we celebrate that difference? And that's the way that this conversation has played out in this set of movements. And I think we do still see that both of those strands in the fight for marriage and the conversation around whether marriage equality was a good way to pull the movement or whether marriage was sort of a mainstream institution that had a lot of problems from the beginning and should be kind of moved beyond in favor of something else.
Wow, that is certainly interesting. I mean, what a concept. Marriage is challenging. What a surprise. I tell you, a lot of people said during that whole struggle, and it's nice to say, you know, there was that period where there was that struggle that we've gone through it, that, okay, gay people want to get married. Good luck, you know? I mean, to me, I just found it not exactly amusing, but strange that somehow these fearful people could think that any other marriage affects any other marriage. I mean, each marriage is its own thing. You know, you're not affected by anybody else's marriage. The fear of the other. We'll talk about that later on. Again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. Our show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about empowerment, liberation. Our guest today is Lisa Stullberg, Associate Professor of Sociology and Education. That's interesting, at New York University, whose new book is LGBTQ Social Movements. And I wanted to ask, for a lot of people in my generation, I'm a boomer, the war, we thought we were without precedent, the anti-war movement. We were something new under the sun. There was nothing we could learn from the past. Boy, were we wrong. It's amazing how we thought that. It just, I'm embarrassed by it. But I wonder about, you teach. What about today's students? Are they curious? Do they know about the history of social and political change? Are they curious about history? And are they, you know, interested in learning about what worked and what didn't work?
This is definitely one of the main motivations for me for writing the book. And also, it's what keeps me going and teaching this class. So I guess I'm a Gen Xer. My first political memories are of Ronald Reagan. So I was a child of the 80s and early 90s. And I remember looking back when I started to become politically active. I remember looking back to the 60s and thinking, like, I should have lived then. Like, that was, there was everything then. And, you know, we have nothing now in terms of a progressive movement and a mass movement. And I think that's where, when I started teaching at NYU, that's where my students were. I started teaching in the Bush W administration, and there wasn't really that sense that there was a mass movement that young people could join, but they were really interested in making social change. And I would say in terms of what they knew about history, they didn't really know very much about history of social change of any kind. As you mentioned at the very beginning, we often think of Rosa Parks as the only in the beginning of the civil rights movement. And that's what young people were learning. They knew Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and that's kind of it.
Right.
And, you know, I even realized in teaching about the civil rights movement that I had to teach about how the court system works in this country and what the Supreme Court does and just sort of basic civic stuff that I don't blame my students for not knowing. They just didn't really learn it. Just understanding the basic sort of three branches of government and how change happens in that way was something that I've had to start with my students. And then I do find that they're really, really interested in history and really interested in learning from and being inspired by history.
Oh, that's so good to hear. That's music to my ears. I love history. I really do. And I often say the one thing I learned from history is that we never learn from history, but sometimes we do. And I'm glad. So there is more of a curiosity now. I don't think there was before. You know, people, I think young people, when I was younger, thought, oh, we were something new. We were really special. We were all these people, the big baby boom. And we weren't so curious, maybe. You know, who knew? I mean, in the 60s, nobody knew anything about the movement in the 30s. Not a thing. So I'm glad to see that they are curious now. And that I'll ask this as a question. They're interested in the values that you and I seem to share, that making it happen, that they see what this world is today. And I mean, back then in the 60s, pretty much everybody was liberal or radical. That was it on the left. And now, what's the sense of, you know, there are, I imagine, some young people who lean to the right. Hard to believe there are older people who lean to the right, but they do. What are they finding? Do they have a sense of drive about this, you know, caring about social, political, and cultural justice?
Well, I think I have this is a sociologist answer, but I think I have a bit of a self-selected sample of being at New York University.
True.
New York University tends to lean a bit more liberal, and then also in the classes I teach, I tend to attract students who also lean left. So that tends to be who I see, but I do think that those students, especially after Trump's election, I will never forget walking into class the day after that election and just teaching the whole rest of that semester and last year, especially in my social movements class. I just think young people going from President Obama to President Trump just had so many questions about how that could happen, and I think they were reaching back to history to try to understand that political change, and then to try to understand how young people throughout history have made change in the face of so many obstacles.
That we have, and sometimes those obstacles turn out to be kind of a blessing. I mean, there's a silver lining. You know, after that horrible massacre down in Parkland, Florida, I am just thrilled to see these high school kids saying, hey, we're not going to take it anymore. We are going to force this change to happen. That is kind of a beautiful thing. And during the 60s, I always thought the best anti-war organizer that we had of all of them was Richard Nixon, because he was so bad on it. And now we got this Trump orange thing out there. This seems to be sort of a good, you must be finding that a little bit as well down in the village in New York City, you know, down on the almost Lower East Side where NYU is, people are getting more involved and they're curious about this. And we talked, of course, about marriage equality, and it's a big deal. No question about it. My niece was one of the first lesbians to get married legally. It's a great thing. And now it's everywhere. But I wonder about this and myth and finding simplistic definitions of things. For a lot of young people, I would think the LGBT movement began and ended with the struggle for marriage equality. I mean, it was a long, hard fight. My sense is that while it was a great, really historic victory, the movement is not over and done. Wonder if you would please put that win within the context of organizing done by gay men and lesbians in the decades prior, and how maybe it's not over and done.
Right. So I think you're right, and you've actually touched on some of the things that I would say are things we need to still focus on. So marriage was really a political issue that came out of the 90s and early part of the 2000s, so relatively new with respect to LGBTQ equality struggles. And there were a lot of early fights about whether marriage was winnable and whether it was desirable as something to fight for the movement.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that we see as one of the biggest public opinion shifts, that we've really seen a huge shift in this millennium on public opinion for marriage equality. And so we see that there can be these civil rights wins, and that was one of them, to go from having no states in the country in, you know, the first states, the first marriages happened in Massachusetts
That's
in 2004
right.
to full marriage equality by 2015. That's a huge
Amazing.
Shift in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah.
And we see public opinion coming along with that. But that even just on the civil rights front, there are still a number of other things we need to fight for, and you mentioned some of these already. So so just job discrimination, for one. There's the saying that people can get married on Sunday and then fired on Monday in many of the states in the country. I think it's now 22 states have job discrimination protections for LGBT actually, I don't think the T is covered in a couple of those states. So just for sexual orientation, fewer than half the states protect gay, lesbian, and bi people against job discrimination. And most of those do cover gender identity, too. But we still need federal protection for just basic civil rights. And we're going backwards in that sense now. We don't have an administration who's willing to entertain federal protections for any minority groups, for the most part. So that would be one, is just basic civil rights. And then I think some of the things we've talked about, too, with respect to cultural institutions and schools, we still need a lot of cultural inclusion, and I would include inclusion in curriculum in schools. Most LGBTQ young people don't learn about other LGBTQ people in their history classes or in their English curricula, or at least they don't talk about those issues, gender and sexuality. So we still have a lot of work to do, but I think one of the things we get from marriage is that public opinion does shift, and it has shifted quickly with this issue.
Yeah, I think it really has shifted very quickly. I mean, just it's been going, struggling for years and years and years, and then boom, an overnight success. And talk about, you know, overnight success. That rarely happens, and I was, you know, sort of joking with that. What role has pop culture played in these movements aimed at securing rights for LGBTQ people? You know, pop culture, I think, is it's amazing. You know, back in the 60s, back in my day, we had, you know, the Beatles and all that amazing music, etc. And it was a big deal in making social change. I've long thought that cultural change precedes political change. What's your sense of the role that pop culture has played in these movements to secure rights?
So this is work that I'm really excited about. I'm actually working on another book with a graduate student at NYU now, specifically on this question of the connection between pop culture and LGBTQ social change. I think that pop culture is a really complicated but powerful space that's important for identity building and community building. I've been thinking about this a lot with and I've been really reading a lot about the conversation around the movie Black Panther and just the representation there about of racial identity and black identity, and the fact that there's so much interest in that, even though the representation isn't perfect, it allows for this really complicated conversation about identity and politics. And I think the same is true for LGBTQ communities, that it's hard to really measure the impact of pop culture, but it's also, in this case, hard not to credit it with shifts in public opinion. I don't know if you remember back to when Vice President Joe Biden came out for marriage equality in 2012. He credited the show Will and Grace. He said that I don't think anything has done more to educate the American public than Will and Grace has. And so we see, you know, these people who are in policy positions crediting popular culture with changing hearts and minds. And I do think it's one of those things with LGBTQ people, unlike with other groups that don't have power in this country. Often LGBTQ individuals don't come from families with other LGBTQ individuals, and that's not true for racial minorities or religious minorities. And so LGBTQ people are often isolated and need to find each other, and pop culture is a way to do that. And it's also a way to educate non-LGBTQ people about LGBTQ experience and identity. And it's a way to really fall in love with and connect with people that are different from us. So having television in our homes and having these intimate connections with characters over long periods of time, we grow to love people and empathize with people that are different from us. And that really helps, I think, with acceptance and inclusion.
And I think of Modern Family. You know, that's a very, very popular show. And there's two guys on there who are, you know, their characters are gay. And it's just part of the modern family. And it's Yeah, obviously, they wouldn't make shows like that unless the advertisers thought they could make money from buying advertisement on there and that it would be popularly accepted. So I mean, we've come a long way from All in the Family to Modern Family.
Yep. Yeah. And people across the political spectrum love Modern Family. It's not just a bunch of liberals watching it. So, yes, that's true.
Yeah, it's interesting how history works. It never moves in a straight line. And I think it's, I've always thought, well, not always, but I think it moves in many directions at the same time. It would be nice if it was a straight line, but it ain't. And I think it was interesting, you know, sort of simultaneous, the mid and late 70s, when the gay and lesbian movement became far more visible, that was the same time as the beginnings of the new right, the American right. You know, Goldwater was called, you know, far right, but he was to the left compared to these guys these days. I mean, the John Birch Society, you, as a historian, you've heard about that, no doubt, but they're long gone because they become the Republican Party. And so in the mid to late 70s, both the gay and lesbian movement was getting fired up, as well as the new right. I wonder if it's coincidence or are the two movements somehow connected? What do you think about that?
I think they're definitely very connected, and I've learned a lot from others who have studied this topic that we see by the late 70s a lot of success in the gay and what was then called the gay and lesbian movement.
Right.
We see civil rights laws changing locally. We see a lot of visibility for gay and lesbian people. And at the same time, we see this rise of the right. So Anita Bryant, who
yes.
at the time was a beauty queen and an orange juice spokesperson, and also an evangelical Southern Baptist. And she used her visibility to start this movement that was called the Save Our Children campaign. That was an anti-gay movement that at first focused on revoking a civil rights law in Miami-Dade County that had just been passed to protect against discrimination by sexual orientation. And she built this nationwide movement and really sparked the beginning of the modern right that really built itself on an anti-gay agenda. And the movement developed in tandem with growth in the LGBTQ movement at the time. And just a few years later, we see Ronald Reagan elected and then the rise of the religious right with really, at the time, the right had not been involved in electoral politics, and through the late 70s up to kind of the early 90s, they became much more involved in presidential politics and electoral politics, and a lot of that had to do with an anti-gay agenda.
Ah, fearing the other. It's gone on for so long. I mean, you know, white people who never had experience with black people were horrified at rock and roll because it meant race mixing, teenagers, white kids dancing with black kids. Once we get to know the other, it's not so scary. And you talked about Reagan. Boy, that was a big political change. I'm not sure most people are aware of how significant Reagan as president was in so many ways of American history, but he was certainly on the other side of equal rights. He was right there with Anita Bryant. Boy, I could not think of her name, and it was, thank you very much. His treatment of AIDS was to pretend it didn't exist. He was governor of California, of course, and there was, you know, tragic results from ignoring AIDS. You contextualize it within a more general conservative or right-wing political philosophy. How did some AIDS service organizations unwillingly prop up this conservative mindset while simultaneously doing necessary work under horrible circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Well, remembering the context for the beginning of the AIDS crisis in the early 80s, there was so little information about what came to be known as AIDS, and there was so much mistreatment of people who were living with and then dying of AIDS, and that they couldn't get treatment in hospitals, even in morgues. And there was so little public attention paid to this disease that got packaged and framed as a gay disease early on, and the mainstream media wasn't that interested in it. And so the gay community was left on its own to provide services for people who were becoming sick and dying. And the AIDS service movement that started in the early 1980s really stepped in to fill that void. So there was an organization that was founded in New York City called the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and then a number of others came after it. And those were really stepping in to provide health care, to provide social services of many kinds, to provide emotional and psychological support for people living with AIDS and dying with AIDS. And scholars have written about this, and people who have been part of the AIDS movement have written about this too, that those service organizations weren't public organizations. They were private volunteer or private organizations that raised money privately. And they did that. Reagan's sort of philosophy was to privatize public service, public services, and to take the state out of the provision of a lot of welfare and social services. And these aid service organizations did that, but they didn't do it in order to work with Reagan. They didn't do it in order to sort of be aligned with him politically. It wasn't really their fault. They were just filling a void that was there. And at the same time, they were sort of working within Reagan's privatized vision of social services rather than seeing social services as something that should be provided by the welfare state. But I wouldn't fault them for that. Their government had failed them, as did the healthcare profession, and they were doing what they could to provide services during a crisis moment.
So we talked a little bit about, you know, things moving in different directions at the same time and splits within movements. There was, of course, the ACT UP movement, which was certainly controversial, even within the LGBTQ movement. You know, they were doing the we're here, we're queer, you're in your face. It was more explicitly politicalized and radical, more focused on direct action mobilization and a confrontation with the state over the neglect of the AIDS issue. How did it all turn out? What's your sense of that? Are there clear lessons from the ACT UP thing? Was it a good thing, a bad thing, some of both?
So ACT UP was a radical AIDS organization that developed in the late 1980s, and it was designed to be a more political response to the AIDS crisis. And it really was an AIDS-focused group. It was focused on holding the federal government accountable for AIDS treatment and drug trials and development. It was designed to hold pharmaceutical companies accountable for accessibility for their drugs. And out of that, I think the conversation there was that the LGBTQ movement, or at that time, I guess it was still really just the gay and lesbian movement, was so focused on the AIDS crisis that there wasn't really as much of a focus on gay and lesbian identity. And so out of ACT UP came this sort of renewed focus on what then became called queer identity. So a group called Queer Nation, which is what you often associate, or what we often associate with We're Here, We're Queer, Get Used to It, developed in the early 90s. And there were other organizations that were radical queer organizations that really weren't focused on AIDS. They were more focused on LGBTQ identity. And I think we still see that the impact of that. One, we have in colleges and universities queer studies programs, so an academic focus on LGBTQ identity. And we still have the focus on these sort of radical actions and performative actions, so actions that are designed to get attention, whether that's a focus on language that seems kind of in your face or a focus on direct action. ACT UP and Queer Nation and other both AIDS and LGBTQ organizations at the time, their focus was on visibility, being as visible as possible and as hard to dismiss as possible.
Well, I wonder, you know, let's face it, it scared people. Some people were scared by it. They thought, oh my God, these crazy people are going to, you know, steal my kids and, you know, all that stuff. What about that? Did it, was there more positive than negative about it? You know, it certainly raised the attention on it. And I suppose just thinking about it could make people who were scared even wonder about that fear. What's your sense of that whole action?
I think it's just like with every movement, you need tactics and strategies on many fronts.
That's true.
And I think Queer Nation and other sort of more radical organizations at the time, they weren't focused on changing laws for the most part. They were focused on cultural change and on asserting an identity, a proud identity. And I think that's a necessary part of every movement. It shouldn't be and it can't be the entire movement. I think we still need the focus on civil rights shifts and legal shifts.
Yeah.
But I think those cultural questions and challenges that Queer Nation raised were really important and have continued still today as we think about the visibility of LGBTQ people in pop culture, mm-hmm. And of what it means to actually include a broad range of gender and sexual diversity in our institutions and our culture.
If you just tuned in, we're coming toward the end of the hour, but the book is called LGBTQ Social Movements. Our guest is its author, Lisa M. Stolberg, and Trump. Okay, here we are. Is it possible? I mean, Obama was clearly a friend to the LGBTQ movement, clearly. Is it possible that a Trump administration, I mean, you got Vice President Pence, who, whoa, what a strange character he is on this. I mean, he's really obsessed with this stuff. Is it possible that they might overturn the 2014 Obama order banning employment discrimination within the federal government? How much of a danger is the Trump administration, do you think? Have we passed the danger point? What are your thoughts on that?
So we could talk about this, I think, for a whole nother hour. But I guess what I would say is that governing by executive order is really precarious.
Yeah.
So President Obama was hugely impactful with respect to LGBTQ rights, especially in his second term. And he did what he could when he didn't have Congress behind him to make law. And so he passed a number of executive orders and made changes at the executive level that Trump can undo because those are not laws that were passed by Congress. And I do think that I think what we're going to see from Trump is a focus on sort of shifts that he can make a bit behind the scenes with respect to LGBTQ rights. So, for instance, the Obama administration reinterpreted Title IX, which is what bars sex discrimination in schools. They reinterpreted Title IX to protect transgender students, and the Trump administration changed that right away. And we see now, I think what we're going to see with Trump is this focus on religious liberty as a way to take back rights for LGBTQ people. I think that's going to be the framing. I think ultimately what we need is a very clear ruling on the 14th Amendment and on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64 that protects against discrimination in jobs.
And what's the 14th Amendment? Not everybody is aware of that.
The 14th Amendment is one of the key civil rights amendments that protects, it gives equal protection to people in various ways. And we don't yet have a clear ruling on whether that equal protection extends to sexual orientation and gender identity. And we need that from the Supreme Court. And so we need some clarification in the laws, but I think until we get that, we're going to see that Trump can do a lot of damage through just executive action.
And I wonder where the public is now on these issues. Are they come along with you and me on this? Or I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are, you know, want to fight back against the liberal gay agenda that they see. I mean, you know, they've been fearful of that for a really long time. And I do want to ask about, you know, even if somebody is not gay or lesbian or, you know, BTQ, I can't help but think the successful techniques, what's been learned by the LGBTQ movement, are well worth studying and replicating. I wonder if you could speak to that, you know, just about how what we all can learn from things like that.
So I think LGBTQ history is American history. And I think some of the big lessons from that I've written about and that we can take, that everybody can take from these movements, are that social change happens in many forms, that there are, if you're not the kind of person who marches in the street or is interested in becoming a lawyer or changing our society through law, there are many things you can do to make social change. So I would say to see these movements as American movements that we can all learn from. And then I think allies, we know that voting right now is almost more important than any time I can think of in my lifetime. And so there's a lot that everybody can do to participate in LGBTQ social change.
And we can all make a difference. That's a lesson that really, a lot of people believed what we were told. Oh, there's nothing we can do. We are powerless. Au contraire, we have a lot of power. And I think that's clearly what the LGBTQ social movement shows. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I'm optimistic. I got to tell you, I am optimistic. What about you on this?
I am optimistic. I know a lot of incredible young people, and I'm counting on them.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thanks, Fred. It's been great to talk with you.
All right. And we got to keep on moving forward. Well, don't you let nobody turn you around. Turn you around. Turn
nobody. Turn you round, you got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land.